my entire childhood is to preserve what my kids will one day enjoy. I want them to still to see the same ants and the same snails and the same slugs, you know. If we don't make a difference here, we're not going to see them again. So it's just the little things, you know, they build up.
This is the Cassis Climate Briefing Podcast, Episode 6. What does the future hold? The last few years have seen children around the world skip school and take to the streets to protest on the onset of climate change.
From Ottawa to London, D.C. and San Francisco, students worldwide skipped class Friday for the youth climate strike.
Students skipping school to protest for climate action. In various countries, mostly European, this has been going on for months.
Protesters such as Greta Thunberg have become icons and voices for those growing up in an age that are foreshadowed by the dangers of global warming.
You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
Research by MIT shows that by 2050, economic growth and population change alone can lead to as many as 1.8 billion people living under some moderate water stress. So what can we do as pension funds, trustees, asset managers and service providers to encourage change and ensure we have a future that has climate change under control and we have a green world for our children? How can we better protect our pensions to not just serve our clients in old age, but their children and their children's children? I am Pat Sharman, Managing Director of Cassis in the UK. Joining me to gaze into the future is Chandra Gopinathan, a Senior Investment Manager with Railpen, and David Hunter, CIO at Renewity. So David, just to kick this off, what's the social impact of energy transition through, for example, job losses and creation and the need for retraining?
Well, look, the energy transition starts with generation, then in transmission, distribution, gets into the economy and gets into industry. And of course, on the renewable side and on the hydrocarbon side, the mix of energy that comes on through the generation, the production is obviously going to change over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And that's itself is going to have a material aspect on those that are employed in and around those major hubs where, you know, whether it's the oil and gas sector or other sectors that use fossil fuels. So transportation, construction, steel, and agriculture in particular. So it's going to be a revolution in change. And if you don't take your electorate and your stakeholders with you on that at the pace that they can go, you are going to get a backlash. There's already one brewing in our definitional terms in financial services around the misuse of ESG, for example, and marketing literature around things that really have barely shifted in nature between some of the old funds pre-ESG and some of the new funds post-ESG rating. So a broader backlash against the energy transition in the population would be disastrous if that became a political movement with some veracity. So I think it's incumbent on all of us who are involved both in the political field, in the financial sector, in the energy sector, that we make sure that we're taking communities with us and not trampling over them because of some dogma that we all want to impose. We just have to make sure that if we involve them, we're more likely to get this a just transition with them involved in defining what is just rather than us enforcing it on them.
Talk very much about communities, but I suppose it's not just communities, it's industries in some cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do we make sure that industries also get that just transition?
Dependent on the industry, some have been skating the free externality for long enough that I'm not sure I have to really care too much about prioritising how they cope with this transition. But across the board generally, I think, again, you've just got to make sure that there is enough time, there is enough support, and that might be government, it might be ownership support, it might be employee support, but there needs to be enough support for things like retraining, shifting and adapting skills that are already there and developing them further with some of the new technologies. And, you know, we have not all done this together as quickly in force ever before, but we have lots and lots of successes around the world that one can point to where you make some small shifts in activity and the local community see the immediate benefits, particularly in biodiversity and looking after the health of flora and fauna, there are great success stories all around the world about how just with a few small changes of lifestyle or use or working practices, there's been a really leveraged and material beneficial outcome for the society and the community there.
And do you think that support is here in the UK?
It remains to be seen. I think the policy noises at this stage of the journey are all loud and they're all very concerned and they're in the same direction. But that is the art of being a politician. I think you have to deliver over time. And the trouble, if anything, with the democratic model on this is that the electoral cycle has to take slightly shorter term decisions around pleasing the electorate. You don't want to impose something where there's no votes. So that educational aspect is going to be, and the communication aspect is going to be critical in that.
Okay, to be seen. So, Chandra, what's your view of the social impact?
We've touched a little bit on the social impact of the transition, energy transition last year through the just transition discussion that David just alluded to. I think some of the impact socially and economically has been felt by members, primarily due to the increase in gas prices, etc., some of which is still attributed to ESG initiatives and energy price inflation and the associated effects. And I think this debate, especially post-Russia, moves into in front and center for sure, because I think there is an impact on affordability for consumers. There is an impact for on affordability for the population as a whole, and energy security, self-sufficiency, all of those things which come into the center. So we've said it last year, we'll say it again, is that the perfect can't be the enemy of good. So we are on a net zero journey here. It is a transitional process. It needs to be balanced. The issues around volatility of prices, the issues around the impact on members and consumers, the issues of energy security and self-sufficiency, all of those need to be balanced. And the approach needs to be flexible. We need to learn. There are lots of unknowns in the process, which we need to be able to factor and incorporate and be dynamic about adjusting our transition to reflect those things. So yeah, that's my take. And I think there will be more surprises, or hopefully not too many, but there will be surprises and learnings more for us coming in from this process, which we need to factor in. And there's things we know, there's things we learn on the way.
And from your perspective, do you actually think that there's the right support in place for this transition to make sure there is that just transition for the individuals and the communities and industries?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to on that. But there is some element of support that is in place, but there is some element of, as David alluded to, the old age and the new age ESG thinking. ESG has been around for several decades now. Corporate social responsibility was always a thing. It started with social. So it was a social responsibility, and it sort of evolved in different ways. And now the financial sector is involved, asset owners are involved, big money involved, and everybody's talking trillions of assets moving one way or the other. So all of that is happening, but there is still a need for balance. And I think a lot of times when a movement goes in one direction, you realize that there are certain basics that are forgotten. And we need reminders of those from time to time. We need to make sure we strike that balance over time to ensure this moves in a fair and just manner.
What would you say were the key benefits for them investing in renewables and the key criteria that they should consider?
The main attraction of renewables is, you know, long-term yield with a great deal of dependency. So the assets structured to date and across most parts of the renewable investing space tend to come with a long-term offtake contract. Effectively, if they do, or if you can get to that position, you are effectively sitting on a credit counterparty asset. And so that creditworthy nature, even though a lot of the investments will be in long buy and hold equity, is, you know, used as a sort of yield play, a surrogate bond, if you like, to deliver some yield with duration. One of the greatest features of the asset class is the long-term duration, which, of course, is not as prevalent in the bond market, for example, as it used to be. So duration, cash flow, long-term dependable income are still pretty key to most pension funds, particularly the maturing pension funds, and a lack of correlation as an illiquid asset with the rest of the portfolio. So the fundamental investment characteristics come first, usually with most pension funds. But of course, the further benefit for investors these days, particularly those of an impact persuasion looking to achieve change in social or wider economic circumstances, or in this case environmental arenas, is that it is immediately carbon mitigating.
Although I'm going to spin that on his head a little bit, mm-hmm. because there's quite a lot of discussion around some ethical concerns on supply chains for renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And they're under scrutiny. So what developments are you seeing in that area?
A couple of things, and this is not a defensive answer. This is a contexting start to the answer, and I'll get into the weeds a little bit more. But there are complications and questions on supply chains in everything from retail, cheap clothing, to car manufacturing. But given that renewables in particular are expected to be excessive to GDP growth strategy going forward, the demand for change in decarbonising assets demands a huge amount of investment. So we see investment rising, and it's right, therefore, that the lens of ethical behaviour is more focused on those, particularly when you're waving the flag at the top of the hill saying, look how ethically sensible and smart we are. And of course, the content of all of these projects is still concrete, it's still metal, it's still engineering, it's still rare earths in particular. If we're a statistic I heard the other day was to that the weight of an electric vehicle car battery is roughly about a kilo, and to produce everything that you need in that kilo of battery stuff that goes in the car, you need to excavate something like 500,000 kilos to get the lithium, the cobalt, the nickel, etc., all the parts that you need in the battery. So my colleague Stephen Brebben calls the 21st century and this decarbonisation revolution the age of mining, yeah. And extraction. So it's going to be a brutal hit to parts of the world where those resources are key. And, you know, that brings up geopolitics and some of the issues that we're seeing now on supply chain constraints.
And we've also seen shortages in the transmission infrastructure. So can you tell me what sort of developments are occurring to resolve those shortages?
It's a really good question. And there's several aspects that we think about in that are opportunities and challenges, both from an investment point of view and from the wider impact point of view. So from an investment point of view, where are there's obviously existing transmission and grid networks in most OECD countries, they tend to be centralized or heavily centralized, not fully centralized. And so part of the problem is that they're not just centralized, but they're relatively antiquated. They're built for largely hydrocarbon sourced energy, with the odd exception of nuclear and hydro, mm-hmm. that's been around for a long time. And in the decarbonization world, those grid networks are really not imperfectly set for what we need going forward. So, for example, we in the UK have just announced recently that, you know, instead of, I think we've raised the target to 40 gigawatts, from 40 gigawatts to 50 gigawatts of offshore wind. And offshore wind, we are, you know, like the Saudi Arabia of wind here in the British Isles, and exploited that resource early compared to some other Europeans, compared to certainly some in the US and Asia. We really are world leader in having proven that technology and scaled it up and brought down the cost of it per unit as a result. However, that needs to be brought onshore. And, you know, at the point of bringing that into the grid, there is a connection necessary, a substation. And, you know, if you go to those local communities, number one, well, I'm not quite sure I'm happy with the horizon anymore.
Yeah.
Number two, I certainly don't want a load of buzzing electricity boxes on the outskirts of the village covering two or three football fields. So I think local community engagement with some of those, you know, offshore to onshore transmissions is going to be key. The whole grid structure, if it's going to bring in more intermittent generating electricity sources such as sun and wind, you know, they're not as constant as burning coal or nuclear. If we're going to bring those onto the grid, the two or three things about that are going to need investment in terms of transmission in the grid are going to be finding ways to make sure that electricity is produced closer to where the demand is. That's just a structural and planning aspect. I think the other aspect of the grid is resilience and latency and flexibility. So there are some aspects of renewable or new technology development that can take out some of that inflexibility that's there in the grid and can make the grid more flexible.
And there's long storage as well, isn't there? Long storage batteries?
Yeah, and look, the long storage batteries are still, you know, not quite there in terms of the capacity necessary, but, you know, there's a great deal more needed to do to bring energy in from renewables there in a way that it can be stored so that it can be brought on stream at a later date. You know, these are, and so things like, you know, using renewables to generate green hydrogen, that's a storage medium, using it to pump water back up to the, you know, the top of the hill where there's a lock, you know, wind and, you know, hydro sometimes are a good match. So I think what we're going to see there is combinations of production and grid flexibility and storage in order to bring forth, you know, a greater influence of renewables on our electricity supply. Without that, you know, the intermittency is going to continue to be more of a problem than a solution for many of the renewable sources.
No one can do everything, someone can do something.
I spoke to Lucy and Matea, two young people, to discuss how they see the future when it comes to climate change.
I hope we realise how all interconnected we are to each other and nature. I hope we wake up and connect to what we fund and what our actions fund to the climate crisis itself. I hope we stop being so cognitively dissonant.
Instead of people saying you need to do it, they also need to do something. People aren't really doing anything about it. They're kind of just brushing it off. But it's actually happening. The world's getting hotter. Oceans are getting polluted. And I think you should, people don't actually realise how serious it is. You can help the animals just by even a little tub of water for animals in your garden.
Now, Chandra, there are some new reporting standards that are coming in, such as TNFD. What do you actually think they mean in practice?
I would just rewind it back a couple of years where climate was before. So what TNFD is trying to do is really to establish the concepts and definitions for assessment of natural capital in a standardized way. So how do you assess and how do I have the concepts and definitions in place so I can provide some standardized assessment of portfolios and disclosure for natural capital? So nature is in four realms. It's land, ocean, freshwater, atmosphere. Biodiversity is an essential characteristic across all of them. And there are definitions for what are environmental assets, what is an ecosystem service. And those definitions are essentially to help you define what the organization's dependencies are and what its impacts are on the environment and what the risks are associated with them as well. So that's really what TNFD is trying to capture, build those definitions in place, put them in context, and allow you to locate how your organization is interacting with nature, allow you to evaluate what sort of dependencies and impact that your organization has on and from nature, assessing the risks associated with that and potential opportunities, whether there's ways to balance, whether there's ways to mitigate systemic risks and help in the transition, and also report on it. So respond and report, and how do you prepare yourself for that and prepare yourself for all of these things. And TNFD is essentially trying to do what TCFD has accomplished over the last 5 years. And I think we're in very early stages, so hopefully it provides a framework to investors for understanding what nature means for their portfolio.
And I think this is where you start to come into double materiality as well. I think it becomes more obvious when you actually talk about nature, because it's the impact you may have on nature, not just on your company. So I find it's a really fascinating framework that we hope to see by 2023. But just another thing for pension schemes and asset managers, of course, to think about and to take into account. I think it's really important, and I understand it. I just hope we don't get to a point where there's a bit of overload.
We certainly hope so too. And I try not to think about it as a burden just yet, because there is a lot of hard work being done for us on this front. So somebody else is doing the thinking, somebody else and experts together are sort of getting together to come up with the concepts and definitions. So that's easy for me, at least that I don't have to think about it and somebody else is doing it for me. And yes, it does impose a little bit of reporting obligations and eventually will. But what I'm excited about is essentially to be able to understand my portfolio and the dependencies, and the dependencies go both ways. So what you do to the environment, what the environment does to you, and understanding that bit and then deciding what to do about it and how you go about it. So it is onerous, but it's also an exciting process for us to move forward into.
So, David, I still don't think we're still not reflecting the scale of the challenge in decarbonisation and the scale of change that is needed. Do you agree with that point?
I think you have to, in reality, slightly dilute the message. We're not looking to shock the system here. So my biggest plea, beyond suitable government and supranational funding to smooth that path, is that the education gets out there, and in particular, we have to set the expectations of what we are able to achieve over what time frame. And that means some failures, okay, and it means some successes. And as Kipling says, don't get too overexcited about the successes and don't get too depressed about the failures, because you will need an even keel for this journey. And so, you know, as I say, the main thing is that the leaders in the pension fund, in financial service industry, and the politicians just are open about some of the challenges ahead whilst they're delivering the mallets on particular sectors, because everyone has to feel, and we've shown, I think, in the last 2 years, that society can come together and make some sacrifices when asked to do so.
Outside the well-known forms of renewable energy, such as wind and solar, what other forms of sustainable energy do you think will emerge?
Well, I mean, there's some easy answers, some hard answers to that. So things that have been around, just to add into the mix, hydro, geothermal. These are 130-year-old, 140-year-old technologies. In hydro in particular, you know, whether it's storage or run-of-river, taking fast water out and taking some energy out there, which is quite prevalent in emerging economies in particular. There's some more to do, just like there's some more to do with solar and wind. And then you've got the slightly more challenging technically at the moment, hydrogen transfer. You've also got tidal, which hasn't really yet taken hold and still needs some more testing and some more work on some of the degradation in salt of some of the pumps and the blades and so on and so forth. So there'll be others. And one of the things that we try to make a lot of noise about is that we don't know which one's going to win, and we're not going to be dogmatic about where or when it should be implemented. In renewables, for example, as I say, you know, sometimes you miss the point that actually it's an immediate mitigant for our carbon. So it doesn't necessarily help us address all the bad things, but it stops us making some of them worse. So I think there's plenty of, you know, I was asked the other day about the magic 5-second fusion output in Oxford. It was all over the newspaper. Someone said to me, how will that impact the renewables industry? I said, I don't know. You know, what I do know is it's going to be 10 years until I know.
Yes.
And so you have to just not be wedded to a particular technology, but those well-proven massive cost reductions bar the last 12 or 18 months, say, in the cost of producing solar and wind turbines has been really beneficial. And so it's incumbent on governments and scale allocators to fund some of that transitional experimentation as the technology improves so that it can be scaled and we can bring down the cost of it.
So, final question to you both. What really needs to happen over the next few years in order for us to meet the Paris Agreement targets in 2050? David?
Well, I think the number one driver is human behaviour. All the technology that we spout forth on and all the data that we work with are all useful at the existential and environmental aspect, but they all have a social cost and they have a social impact. I'm kind of reaching for the International Energy Authority's 10-point plan on how to wean us off Russian gas, for example, as a little piece of learning. And I think item 3 or 4 on that list was, genuinely, we should turn down our thermostat by 1 or 2 degrees. And, you know, little simple things like that, you know, put on another jumper in the winter, it's fine. But that, again, needs mediating across the right sectors in society. You know, you can't do that with 65, 70-year-old pensioners on their home in their, you know, with one heating source. So I think if we can get changes in behaviour, more responsible behaviour with the population, I think that will be probably the biggest impact, bigger than any other technology advance that I can think of.
So, Chandra, what are your thoughts? Do you think behaviour is a big factor?
I do think behavior is a big factor, but I don't think it's the only one. I think we've spent a lot of time waiting for people to change their behavior. Some of it has happened, some of it is enforced, but I think there's a lot of other things we could be doing alongside with it. I'm not suggesting that behavioral change, and I do like the IEA's 10-point plan in terms of reducing thermostats, and I think that is a, in times of dire need, that is something that needs to be done. But in terms of what else needs to happen, I mean, it hasn't changed. What we've asked for last year and what we've sort of pushed for hasn't really changed. We need engagement. We need decarbonization. We need companies, especially the heavy emitters, to change their business models. We need to learn from the unintended consequences and feed those back into our process. When externalities happen, like we are in right now, and those things are beyond our control, we need to incorporate those learnings as well and be flexible, incorporate those things. And we need to keep at it. And as David said, we need to keep an even keel around maintaining the balances and remembering that this is for the longer term. And when there's volatility in the short term, we just need to manage it through everything that we've said last year and beyond. And once we keep at our short term and our medium term targets, net zero 2050 will automatically follow.
I just want to close by emphasising that we all have important impact in managing climate change. This often gets lost as the term impact investing becomes more widespread, because this technically only defines investments that have measurable benefit on the environment or social impact. It's not science-based. I think the definition of impact is much broader than this and applies to everyone, whether you're an asset manager, pension scheme, trustee, consultant or individual. Our collective actions in helping to reduce carbon emissions ultimately contributes to the Paris Agreement target of limiting temperature increases to 1.5 degrees to pre-industrial levels. This is impact.
I hope we become less reliant on fossil fuels in energy production. So that's a major one that I think that government-wise and individually we all need to implement. I understand we're here today because of the fossil fuel industrialisation period, but it's time now that the signs could not be bigger or brighter that we need to change.
You've been listening to the GACIS Climate Briefing. I'm Pat Sharman. Goodbye.